How do we prevent technology from destroying us? In the case of developing countries, the answer is not what most think. We give the answer today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. This is Mind Matters, where we talk about artificial intelligence and the latest technology versus natural intelligence. And we have been talking about so-called appropriate technology. The idea is that we know about what AI is doing and what it might do in developed countries, such as self-driving trucks and replacing workers at factories. But how is new technology and AI going to affect the developing countries? And how best might we introduce it to the developing countries? So that's what we've been talking about. This is a third in the sequence of podcasts with Professor Brian Thomas. Brian is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Baylor University. He is the faculty in residence at Baylor's Teal Residential College, where undergraduate engineering and computer science students eat, live, and learn together. We found out last time that Teal was one of the inventors or one of the first proponents of the transistor, and he was a Baylor alumni. Professor Thomas is also the founder and current faculty advisor to an incredible award-winning student organization named Engineers with a Mission. In previous podcasts, we have talked about, number one, what is appropriate technology? What is its history? What are its different flavors? And then in the podcast immediately before this, number two, we talked about some of the things that Engineers with a Mission have done in introducing technology to third world countries. Today, I would like to talk about the broader impact of potential AI in these developing countries. Satya Nadella, he's the CEO of Microsoft, and he wrote a book called Hit Refresh. Nadella laments in 2 years, only 16% of the world's poorest population, and overall only 55% of the world's population will have access to the internet. Poor us. At the current rate, he says we won't have near 100% access until 25 years from now. Cell phone use is likewise on the rise in many developing countries, allowing greater communication. He notes Malawi, one of Africa's former poorest countries, has been revitalized in the last decade in the use of cell phones. So, Professor Thomas, we were talking at the end of the last podcast how in your visits you have seen cell phones in use in third world countries. And could you talk a little bit about what your assessment of the impact of the cell phone introduction has been?
Well, I haven't studied it formally, but I have seen everywhere I've been, there have been cell phone users. And sometimes these are often people that may not even have electricity in their homes, but they have a cell phone. And so you may ask, how does one charge a cell phone if you don't have electricity?
Good question.
Well, yeah. Let's say, Bob, you're my neighbor, and I hear that you're going into town next week to buy a new machete at the hardware store. I'm going to give you my phone and a little money. And while you're there, I want you to find an outlet and plug in my phone and charge it up for me and bring it back when you come back the next day. And I'll pay you for it. Or if we're family, then maybe you'll do it for me for free. Another possibility is that someone has a small solar panel in their home and is able to charge. And so there are cell phone charging businesses in the world whose whole purpose is to charge people's cell phones. In fact, we helped start such businesses in Haiti by putting in a single solar panel in some poor people's homes and establishing a network of small family businesses where...
So people can bring their cell phones to these poor homes and get them recharged.
That's right.
And the people at the poor home make a few pennies.
They do. And I forget what the rates were, but there was a significant increase in income on one of our most successful business owners, a woman named Sonia. And she was operating a cell phone business. And we went to check on her a year later, and it was great because just as we were pulling up, one of her customers was leaving, having just had her cell phone charged and paid. And we went inside, and we looked at the system, and One of the innovations we saw that she had implemented was she didn't have the right charger for everyone's cell phone. And so what she had done is taken the charger apart, and she would, if you bring your phone in, she will take the battery out and directly connect it to the wires coming from the charger instead of using a little adapter or something like that. And she would charge the batteries individually without any type of adapter, just a direct connection of the wires. And then once it was all charged, she'd put it back in your phone for you and give it back to you.
So I know that the cell phones that are used in third world countries are not made by Apple or
Samsung.
Mm-hmm. They're not made by Apple or Samsung, but rather they are manufactured elsewhere, and they're not as good of quality. They don't have the flexibility that the cell phones you and I are familiar with.
Yes, there's a mixture. I've seen iPhones in Haiti. They sometimes are a model or two older. Maybe sometimes they've been given by, you know, visiting Americans. But you're right. There is also a large class of cell phones that is manufactured elsewhere. And so we're talking about being able to buy a cell phone for about $25 and having a prepaid system where you don't even have to – there's no hookup charge. There's no – I mean, you have to buy a SIM card. But after that, you pay on a pay-per-use basis. So if you need to use your phone, you can go down to the local store, buy a little card with a scratch-off number, enter the number into your phone, and now you've got, you know, 30 minutes of credit.
Oh, really?
Okay, right. It's prepaid, right. And when you run out of credit, the conversation stops, sometimes abruptly in the middle of your important negotiation.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of the systems are also made where you can continue to receive calls, but you can only make calls, place calls, if you have credit. Also, texting takes less bandwidth than a phone call, so a lot of people will just text because it's cheaper. And sometimes, if I'm in my last few cents of credit, then I might send you a text and say, Bob, call me, because I don't have enough credit to call you and tell you I need to talk to you, but I can send you a text because it only costs.
So poor people are texting the rich people to give them a call if they want to talk to them, right?
Yes.
Interesting.
And it's a very often a lot of these places, in fact, just about everywhere compared to the United States, is a more community-oriented culture, less individualistic. And so there's even a way to send credit to your friends. So I can say, hey, Bob, I'm out of cell phone credit. Can you send me some? And you can enter a special code and my phone number into your phone, and it beams credit over to my phone. And now I can basically use that however I want.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, these cell phones, they provide access to market data. If you make your living selling corn that you raised on your 2-acre farm, then you want to know whether, you know, which city is offering the best price for that corn, and whether or not you're getting a good deal, or if you're in isolation, you can't communicate. You don't know what the running prices of things are. People can take advantage of you. But if you know that what the market price is for a particular product, then you're empowered and you can not be taken advantage of.
So it helps with the invisible hand of free enterprise.
I suppose it does. Yes.
Okay. One of the things that Nadella says is that in 25 years, he believes that the world will have nearly 100% access to the internet. I'm going to ask you to put on a prophet hat now and ask you, what would be the impact of access to the internet to the sort of countries that you've visited?
Well, I know that there's an appetite for cat videos no matter where
you
go.
For what kind of videos?
Cat videos.
Cat?
Yeah. Don't you want cat videos?
Oh, of cute little kittens and things?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm not a big fan of cat videos.
Well, that's the best use of the internet.
Are there cell phones available to do that, to tether to the internet so that they can watch things on it? Or?
Yes, there are. It's just like it essentially is. My experience has been that the cellular connection is the weak link. Not the fact that I have a phone in my hand that is capable of streaming video, but that the cellular backbone in the country is not sufficient for me to do that. So when I'm in Haiti, for example, and I work in Cap Haitian on the northern coast, I can't really access internet or even make phone calls during the maybe from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. because everyone is trying to use it at that time, and the whole system is overloaded, and you just can't get through. So what I'll often do is send a text message, and then I'll put my phone on my nightstand and go to bed. And in the morning, I find that sometime during the night, my phone was able to access the cellular network and send my text message.
You know, I had heard of this, of I think it was a Boy Scout retreat where they couldn't get cell phone service. So what they did is they took a helium balloon, they attached the cell phone to it and raised it up about, I don't know, 100 feet or something like that. And all the text messages downloaded. And so they could pull it back. Oh, and not only did the messages download, but the ones that they have typed the previous night before uploaded. Yeah. So next time you go to Haiti, take a helium balloon with you and you might be more successful.
Well, I tell you, one time we were coming back from a nearby town. I had a driver who had his own vehicle from the Dominican Republic, and we had driven over to a town to buy some PVC pipe, and we were coming back, and all of a sudden smoke started coming out of the dashboard, and, well, his car caught on fire. And so, you know, after we got the car fire out, then we were trying to call for help because we couldn't get the car started again, and I had to go climb a hill, and once I got on the top of the hill, I could get cell service and I could call for help. But while I was standing down at the road level, I couldn't get it.
Fascinating. Now, Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, also said, he asked the question, how can we make technology available to everyone? And then I think that that's an interesting question. And then how can we ensure that it works to benefit everyone? So in the last one, he's kind of addressing the idea of appropriate technology. I can think of the cell phones and the internet as being something which might be appropriate for technology for these third world countries. What about other technology? Nothing really comes to mind in terms of artificial intelligence. Maybe a self-driving car would be really nice to have in the third world.
I don't know. That seems like a pretty let's go with the first question. Paul Pollack, who is pretty famous in development circles, has a few principles. One of his principles is miniaturization. So if you can't afford a horse, let's figure out a way to make a quarter of a horse, or an eighth of a horse, or a sixteenth of a horse. That's more affordable. And then with that fractional horse, I can earn income, use the profits to buy a second fractional horse, and eventually work my way up to that formerly prohibitive hurdle of buying a whole horse. Well, the idea with cell phones could be the same. You're going to need to make the technology, you're going to have to package it in small, inexpensive bits that can be added together or that can be accumulated over time. That's one thing that's going to be necessary to bringing technology into poorer developing countries. And that also probably means we're going to have to give up some capability at first with these devices.
Have you seen any pushback from any of the cultures to uses of things like cell phones? I can't think of any, but I'm just wondering if you have.
I have not seen any person in the countries I have visited that was lamenting the invasion of cell phones or anything like that. Everyone, for example, well, I can't say the same about other American restaurants and other aspects of Western culture, but the cell phone penetration has been uniformly well received from my experience.
Okay. So nobody's bringing up any problems.
I have not seen that. Now, I have seen internet access, people that are concerned about gambling and pornography via internet access, but that's usually not done on a phone. It's more at a PC level.
And you didn't see very many PCs, probably, or laptops.
Not too many. You have to go, again, it's kind of like the horse. If you can miniaturize the horse, it makes it more affordable. Well, what do you do to make the computer less and less expensive so it can be affordable? So anyway, they're not affordable often, and that means they're in internet cafes, businesses where you don't actually own the PC, but someone else owns it, and you just come in and use it for a fee, for an hourly fee.
I wanted to get your reaction to an English journalist and renowned atheist, Matthew Paris. Paris was raised in Malawi, and became actually and spent a lot of time around Christian missionaries, though. He went back to Malawi, and he noticed some people that were building wells. So it was kind of appropriate technology. These were external, I believe, mission people that were building wells. And he noticed an incredible difference in the attitudes of those places which had been affected by the Christian missionaries and evangelism, as opposed to those that hadn't. And he said a very interesting statement, especially for an atheist, and I'm quoting now. He said, "Removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete." In other words, we're coming full circle, because we're going back to what you talked about previously, is that in introducing new technology to a developing country, you can't just consider the technology. And you can't make the mistake, I think, that early missionaries did, that everybody should, the natives of the United States, the Native Americans, should dress and act like Western Europe.
Westerners,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
And so they tried to clothe them, which wasn't appreciated. And so there were these cultural clashes. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit more, about the cultural clashes, and maybe even Paris's idea that if you didn't have this cohesion, if you will, that it would be, I like this phrase, it would be a fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. He said that he used to think that all
of— I think that's a great quote.
Isn't that a great quote? Why do you think it's great?
Because it touches on a lot of the real problems in developing countries. Let's start at the end, the machete. Gary Haugen is the founder of he's the CEO, rather, of International Justice Mission. He's written a book called The Locust Effect, in which he discusses the nature of violence and the pervasiveness of violence in the developing world. He says, until we solve these problems of violence, our efforts to drill water wells and put in solar panels and things like this are missing the point, because they're going to be used and abused by people who are going to use violence to the strong that are able to use violence against the weak in developing countries. And so that technology just enables them to do it more effectively. So one of the things about the Christian worldview, about the big emphasis on loving your neighbor as yourself, has no room for violent acts and of course theft and murder and sexual assault and all these other horrific problems that are part of part of the developing world, are all addressed in character reformation of the Christian worldview. The Christ is about rebuilding and reconciling these broken relationships between people, between humans and God, between humans and other humans, and even the relationships between that we have with ourselves, our self-understanding and our identity, and also with creation around us.
Well, this is interesting, because Paris actually said up to one time he would think that every tribal belief, and I guess he was talking about Malawi because that's where he was raised, but every tribal belief was in a relativistic sense equivalent to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he has abandoned that and said, it isn't working. It isn't working. You still have this conflict. And it goes back to what you were talking about, of the strongest coming in and taking over this built infrastructure of high technology for political and personal gain.
Yes.
And
exactly.
That's what he was addressing. And I guess that's why he put the machete at the end of that.
Exactly.
Statement.
That's symbolic of interpersonal violence, and also even police violence and the abuse of power in general.
Have you noticed this in any places, either implicitly or explicitly?
This is more something that I've read about. In fact, Gary Haugen in his book talks about that even a seasoned visitor will typically not see these things because of two reasons. Both the victim and the perpetrator are trying very hard to hide it.
They're putting on their best face.
They're putting on their best face. Even the victim, because the victim doesn't want first of all, they're ashamed. They've been told it's their own fault. And they have no power to really combat the system combat the abuse, the violence, the sexual assault in court because they don't have the money to pay the legal fees. Really, the money does go with the rich and powerful, or the rich become the powerful, rather, in these places. And, and there's a certain amount of immunity that they can get away with just about anything. I highly recommend The Locust Effect.
Okay, so the book is The Locust Effect by, how do you spell his last name?
Gary Haugen, H-A-U-G-E-N.
Okay, Haugen, okay.
The other thing, the other quotes we had up there were Nike. I think Nike symbolizes American free market economics. I'm not sure I would include the mobile phone up there with the machete and the witch doctor and Nike. I think the mobile phone is the most positive of those.
I don't think the list is necessarily of all negative things. It's just all of the things that are impacting what is happening. So I guess the witch doctor would correspond to the tribalism.
Tribalism, yeah. And what you were talking about earlier with the cultural norms of each culture. And let's, you know, is each cultural norm a equivalent? Okay. Well, if so, that means the culture that practices female genital mutilation is equally valid as some others that are full of, you know, kindness and compassion, for example. So that's an unsustainable viewpoint, I think. And when you see the transformative power of a unified worldview, like the Christian worldview, it comes in and it can transform entire individuals and, of course, cultures at large. And that's I think, what the essence of this quote is, that if there's no moral underpinning, then all we are left with is business and violence and tribalism.
Ravi Zacharias, who is a Christian apologist, said something which I think is in support of this. He says, all we have done, and I will insert in the development of high technology such as AI in both the developing world and the developed world, all we have done is being more sophisticated in the way we are destroying our culture. And this gets back, I think, to the idea of the infrastructure and these things being abused in terms of their use. We're seeing some of those. I don't want to mention Google or Facebook or anything, but there is the type of abuse that comes with that. So,
yeah, you've got to keep in mind that if your worldview thinks that humans are fundamentally good, then unleash the technology and it will be used for good. If your worldview, however, says that people are fundamentally flawed, maybe they're created good, but they're inherently flawed, then they're going to use that technology in selfish ways, perhaps in violent ways, and at least as a minimum, as in self-serving ways. To the extent that we have a moral framework, we will use technology morally.
Excellent. Well, Professor Thomas, thank you for your time. We've been talking to Brian Thomas, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Baylor University. He is also the founder and faculty advisor for Engineers with a Mission that takes technology appropriate to developing countries, and actually looks at implementing it there. So this is Mind Matters, and until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.